say, hello and welcome to the Bloodstream Podcast, day three of our coverage here from Glasgow, Scotland, of the World Federation of Hemophilia's 2018 World Congress. Doing something a little bit differently today, not just going to recap the day, but I actually am joined by a special guest from the UK. I'm trying to think of like a fun way to drag this out, but maybe we should just have you say hi, Lawrence. Actually, Lawrence, is it Woolard or Woolard?
Woolard.
Okay, because in the US we would say Woolard, but I feel like in the podcast I've gotten it right because I practice, but I always want to say Woolard. But it's Woolard.
It's Woolard.
It's Lawrence Woolard from the UK. Hello, Lawrence.
Hey.
How are you?
Hey, Patrick. Yeah, this is awesome. This is so awesome. I'm loving this already.
Thanks. You mainly just like it because we're in such a cool setting, right? Such a really neat hotel room.
Do the listeners actually know? Okay, they do.
I have no idea. Okay. No. I'm just in a very modest hotel room, but I was talking it up earlier as though it was something much more... and it's a lot like a freshman year dorm room, but
yeah,
you know
totally.
What? Who's sad about that?
Am I allowed to ask you a question?
Sure.
First?
Let's go. Let's just get started.
What's your initial experience of Glasgow? How
do
you find it being on UK soil? Well, Scottish soil, actually, I should say.
I love
enjoying
it. Yeah. Other than being like body clock off much longer than I anticipated, it's been amazing. I mean, the weather's been beautiful and it's May, so we're certainly benefiting from
You're
that.
You're so lucky. You have no idea.
Well, I mean, I have a little bit of idea. We spent, you know, my dad's from Ireland. My mom's dad's from Ireland. We spent a lot of time in Ireland growing up. It's obviously not the same place, but we'd be there for 10 days, 2 weeks and see the weather variance there. And there's like 8-9 days in a row where it's just like gray and rainy.
Totally.
So I was kind of prepared for that, but this has been absolutely glorious. And we're in such a cool spot in Glasgow. And I did talk about this a little bit day one, so I won't spend too much time. But it's such a historic area. And having the, the city council member who came to just talk about like the folk history of, the Clyde River
and
it being the precipice of the world beyond Glasgow. And it was like, this is a
They've really embraced it. Like the whole community have embraced it. The Uber driver knew about it.
That's
you know,
cool.
The local people around, the hotel. It's awesome. It's
That's really
awesome.
Interesting. And what a beautiful venue to have a major conference.
Definitely.
How often are you, where do you live exactly? Like help, if most of our listeners are American, help us. You know,
set
we're American. Yeah, we need geography help anytime we're going to talk about the world.
Everyone, so like normally when we're away, right, everyone kind of knows London, of course.
Yeah,
right? Everyone knows London.
Even though,
Why did I say kind of?
No, you're right, though. No, you're right. Because if you put England up, just England, and you said to your average American, point out where in England London is, they wouldn't do it correctly.
Yeah.
You know that,
really?
Right? Like we wouldn't do that correctly.
Okay.
Absolutely not.
But what about the royal wedding, though? I mean, that's been
I couldn't
more
care less.
No mention of the royal wedding.
No,
okay.
Don't care at all. I know plenty of Americans do. I'm not one of them.
Okay,
I couldn't care less.
So I'm just outside of London. So I'm originally from a place called Essex, the county of Essex. So I'm very proud. And I'm sure if any of the listeners actually check out Essex, it's got some reputation, which we're not going to comment on here, but but it's I love it. Yeah,
so
I'm really
intrigued.
Proud from Essex. So just outside London.
And when did you start? So you're, if you don't mind my saying that,
Please.
You're 28,
yeah,
right?
28.
Severe hemophilia A.
Yeah.
And you've been doing a lot of work in the recent past on, and I know we're here to talk about the Congress, but just for anyone who might not be aware of you, can you just give us like the 30, 45 second overview of the work you're doing and why you're doing it?
Totally. I think, I really appreciate it. And it's really like I've been involved in sort of the hemophilia community now for about 4 or 5 years. And it all started with just volunteering. And it's amazing, like that one opportunity, that one network opportunity, which actually my hemophilia center in London put on for patients and families and just to come together. And I always think now, Patrick, I'm like, I used to work in Southwest London and they were hosting this social in Central London on the tube, man. That's like 45 minutes. Mm. And I always think to this day, what made me go all that way after work? It was like a weeknight, to go and engage. And literally from that one event, I met someone and it's just a domino effect ever since. And it's absolutely amazing. So, so now it's very much obviously really trying to spearhead sort of advocacy and a particular interest in young people. And, you know, we've spoken about this before. And so I'm really trying to really look at supporting youth education. And that's really transpired from my own personal experience of really only becoming engaged in my 20s.
Yes. Which is not an uncommon experience. It might not be most people's, but you hear about people finding the community in adulthood. You know, not just parents of newly diagnosed, but patients who, for whatever reason, I mean, I'm one of them. I had a camp community of kids who had different kind of medical conditions, because I went to a camp for kids with different kinds of medical conditions, but I didn't have the bleeding disorders community. So mm-hmm. I had a community, but it didn't provide me with the education on my disorder, the advocacy issues particular to my disorder, insurance and clinical issues.
Totally.
You know, so it gave me a sense of like, I'm not different, I'm not other than, or, you know, I am, but we all are. So I had that going, but it wasn't until I got involved with the bleeding disorders community at 23 as well-ish, about the same time you did, that I got all these other resources that I didn't realize I was missing. You know,
and that's the thing.
It's kind of the scary part if you think about it. Like, to kind of start talking about this Congress with the amount of stuff that's going on.
It's just crazy.
It feels like daily at this point. You know,
it is,
and I'm an American, so between our politics,
yeah,
and the bleeding disorders world, every day I just wake up going, "Well, let's see what today brings."
But that's the thing, though. Like, I think I totally admire like what you guys are, like, just, you know, the advocates out in the States and the activity and like the knowledge and the experience. I think here in the UK, I think it's trying to help others recognize this community exists.
Yeah.
Like, under that roof.
Yeah.
You know, all those people.
Yeah.
Are invested in supporting people like us.
Right.
Like, when you actually step back and think about it, I think somebody told me today around 4,900 people are in there,
wow,
all to do with bleeding disorders. Like, that's surreal when you think about it.
And to your point, how many of them are leading physicians, are leading patient organization leaders, are leading patient educators and advocates? So the numbers themselves are powerful. But when you think about who those individuals are and the reach they have when they take this experience back home, that's the exponential impact is tremendous.
Totally.
So give us a little insight into, from your perspective, what this Congress thus far has been like and is intended to do. And I don't know, for you coming from, you know, in many ways we have a lot in common, both severe A, both young adults, you know, similar age, few years older, but 32, 28, for all intents and purposes, same age group. Severe A, we're both very active in patient engagement,
yeah,
and empowering patients with information and education. What did you come into this meeting hoping to get out of it, and how has that tracked for you thus far?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think, one, for me, a lot of these meetings really about connections. That's always like my primary purpose. It's just a great opportunity to not only reconnect with people, but actually, as you said, like all the different people from all the, you know, multidisciplinary care.
Yeah, in 45 minutes, you're just talking to this guy from Zambia about this thing. You're talking with this person from Malaysia about another thing, an Irish guy about another thing. It's incredible.
It's totally remarkable.
Yeah. And they really reinforced that too. I remember in the opening session, there were numerous comments about connections and networking, That's a big point of emphasis here.
Massive
as well.
Massive point. And really also, I think, as like you just alluded to at the start, just the hive of activity currently. I'm genuinely struggling to keep up. Like, every day when you're just reading another report, whether it's a market report or whether it's news about data or whether it's someone from the community sharing something, like, it's just, it is like a massive hive of activity. And since I've been engaged, it's never been so much, I think. Or whether that's, I don't know.
No, actually, I think that's
is
true.
Is that more just because, like, you know, as the more you get involved, the more you become informed and the more you're interested.
And once
you know,
buy a Ford car, you see more Ford cars. Like, there, that is true. There's, like, forget what that's called, but that, there's an actual, like, that's a thing. But also, there's two other things at play that influence why this is a particularly charged time. Number one is that scientifically, we are just going so fast in the extended half-life products, and we saw some interesting data that was presented today around those and patients' choices who have gone on those. Then obviously the non-factory replacement therapies, the first of which is on the market now in Hemlibra. Then all the gene therapies, which is dominating most of the conversation about novel therapies. The introduction of more medications for people with von Willebrand disease. So we are at a prolific time from a medical development, an investigational therapeutic POV. So that's going on. And then digital and social media means that we all find out a lot more information than we used to. And one of the things that I keep saying, and I have a feeling we'll agree, but maybe not, is that whether you like it or not, patient organization, physician, whomever, whether you like it or not, because there's so much money around this, and there are financial papers and reporters and stakeholders who are putting things out into the world, there's a journal that's accessible online. Mm-hmm. So the information gets to patients sooner than it used to.
Yeah.
And it's incomplete information, especially when it's about clinical trials and their extensions and all of this, you know, yet to be kind of quantified and assessed information. Like, we don't have the privilege anymore of waiting for an entire trial to take place, for the article to be published in a peer-reviewed journal, and all these people to have stared at it and come to conclusions and to have messaged it and packaged it and delivered it as, here's this thing. We are now part of that whole process. And that's not changing. No. So, you know, there's a hesitation to want to comment, I think, sometimes from certain organizations and certain leadership levels in those organizations because it's too early, or, you know, we don't want to get mixed up in the hysteria. But it's like, this is the conversation is happening whether you participate in it or not. And what I think we all need to be doing is what you and I are doing, which is, number one, trying to keep up with it as best we can we're not scientists, we're not physicians, right? We're trying to keep up with it as patient advocates and educators, and then translating it in a way, and this is such an important part of it, so that it's digestible to people, so that it's not just reading a journal article that for the most part is written by scientists and doctors for scientists and doctors. You know, we have to kind of also play that translator role. So I do think what you're acknowledging, when you get more involved in something, you're more aware of its particulars, but there's also a prolific thing going on medically, and there's a prolific thing going on communication.
I literally couldn't have said it any better myself. That was remarkable, but it's true. And you know what? I think the conversations with all different stakeholders in there, Twitter, it's unbelievable. We talk about online influencers. Have you had Professor Mike Makris on
every
here
day?
Yet?
No, you want to know something? He's the one person who's turned me down.
No.
The only person who has said no to being on my podcast.
So I don't know how much.
Ever. And not just even this podcast.
Oh, no.
I've been doing podcasts one way or another for 8 years. I've had journalists. I have had actors and CEOs. And he's the only. Andy Slavitt, who used to run the Affordable Care Act and Medicare and Medicaid for President Barack Obama. Andy Slavitt.
He was even on.
He was on the Bloodstream podcast.
We should do a public call to Mike Makris.
That's right? What this is.
This is a public call to Mike Makris.
You hear that, Professor? You can tweet all you want, but Lawrence and I know that you're hiding. I can't edit this out, Lawrence.
Honestly,
we're committed now.
Like, it's that, you know, for the listeners,
he's fantastic.
He's a great model, though, in terms of someone that's totally independent in terms of their perspective. And the amount of information that I've been able to pick up on.
Me too.
Just
Me too.
Being able to engage with Mike Makris's tweets. 100%. I think for your followers as well. Like, he's a great person to like. And I think you've promoted it before as well in terms of saying, like, guys, you know, across the pond, you know, follow Mike Makris. He's a great case in point. And I think actually speaking to some of the clinicians, it's quite interesting that they even had a session on social media use.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Here.
Oh, as part of the clinician's
track? And I think that's really significant, actually, because I think they're obviously acknowledging that actually it's a really great way.
More of them are on there, I've noticed.
Yeah,
there's
they have.
On there.
And even like I was spending some time with some of the UK physio, actually the European physio group, and even them, they've just set up an account because they need to show they're being a little bit more active. It's really positive.
Yeah.
It's really, really positive. And I just hope actually more of them, you know, more clinicians and more guys across the community actually just get on board. And it's just a great way of information sharing and exchange.
It really is. And, you know, in general, having digital and social media helps us be globally connected as a community, as a, you know, ultimately a small community spread across the globe. But Twitter in particular for information, because it's these bite-sized chunks, and I feel like choose your whatever your nerd topic is. Like for me, my three kind of big nerd buckets are the bleeding disorders bucket, the NBA, and politics. Yeah, those are my three buckets. And the people who I think are amongst the like intellectual higher-ups in those, the hemophilia one doesn't necessarily apply because it's a smaller, but I mean, but Professor Makris and like Brian O'Mahony.
Yeah, Brian's on it now as well, isn't he? He's doing great.
He's crushing it.
Yeah, totally.
And like, so they're doing a great job. That we need more people like them. Stacey Croteau, who's a clinician, I think she's the director of the HTC, or at least one of the HTCs in Boston, Massachusetts. Okay. She's excellent. I've hosted a panel with her on before. She was on our Powering Through podcast. She's now on there as of this Congress too, and likewise contributing in excellent ways. But the other verticals that we shouldn't spend too much more time on this, but like NBA world, politics world, the people who I want to hear from, they're sharing in real time on Twitter. you know, and they're engaging with other people and debating things on Twitter. And it's like, yeah, Facebook, they're not all the same. If you want information, you want to see some of the leaders and KOLs in certain areas you're interested in, friggin' get on Twitter.
Yeah, definitely.
We have to help Twitter help itself.
Just last point on that. Do you ever do hashtag hemophilia?
Yeah, all the time.
And like, but do you search hashtag hemophilia?
All the time.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that. I thought I was such a loser. You're not the only
one. Dude, there are so many times where I've looked at the clock and I've caught myself like looking up alternative spellings of von Willebrand disease as I'm searching. And not even the hashtag, but just people who are writing it. And alternative spellings, and it's like 1:15 in the morning, and I'm like, you have to stop.
Yeah.
You have a problem, and you have to stop. You're a hemaholic.
Hemaholic. This is a new one. You need to go to a meeting. I like that, yeah.
And you have to stop. So tell me, we're like basically halfway through the Congress now.
Can you believe that, though? Can you actually believe that?
I mean, it's yes and no. It's almost like a great vacation where the days are so long, but the weeks fly by, because these days are long, and I was a little under the weather today, which of course makes, you know, a day of concentrated information take longer.
I was gonna say, how's your ankles?
Days fly by.
How's your ankles?
My
feeling?
Ankles are okay. I'm in good. I'm in really good physical shape coming into this meeting, which always helps.
It's a serious point, though, like, isn't it? Like, it's so physically demanding.
You're on your feet so long, walking around. I mean, Orlando, this isn't as big as the place we were in Orlando, but Orlando, it was like a track meet every time you had to go to a new session.
It was huge. Gigantic. It was huge.
You know, this is a little bit more manageable for a Congress of, albeit, like you said, nearly 5,000 people.
Yeah.
Has there been anything thus far, either today, yesterday, any point of the Congress, that has surprised you or has stood out to you as something that maybe you didn't expect to take away from this, or a connection you didn't expect to make, a point that came up that was just like, wow, I had no idea about that? Anything like that come across?
Oh, I think, like, yeah, I mean, as you said, I mean, I've totally made, in terms of the connection wise, yeah, I mean, massively. I think it's just, as you said, it's just the conversations around the novel approaches. I think the late-breaking data around the emicizumab, there was a lot of activity around that. I was really pleased to actually be able to make it into that and just kind of feel the vibe and feel the reaction to some of that.
Yes.
You know, and some of the commentary around that. I don't think I've got a personal perspective or view on that at the moment. Mm-hmm. I just think it's just really good to be kind of a part of that, you know, hearing some of that conversation ongoing. I think, like I mentioned to you as well, it was the first morning that I tried to reach the, tried to get to the 6:45 symposia.
Yeah.
And I think if I've got any advice for anyone listening or any of the WFH guys that have organized this, just to say that, you know, can we please readdress this 6:45 start? And just to say, actually, unfortunately, I didn't even make it for the start. But that was great. I mean, there were some big guys this morning speaking. David Lillycrap, Dr. Dan Hart from the UK. You had Mark Skinner, who I totally admire. And I think that's something that's really coming out of this meeting, is all about that sort of patient-reported outcomes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Really thinking about what is it, like what does it really mean for us?
And I mentioned this previously on these recaps, but Glenn Pierce, I think on the day one, during one of the sessions before the opening, during the daytime of day one, had made a comment summarizing in a gene therapy session about, maybe it was gene therapy, but the point was around advocacy and the need for data-based patient outcomes in order to support advocacy efforts. We need to be making sure that we are collecting internationally rich data so that when we are making our advocacy pleas, it's backed by data. Data drives
really
decision
important.
Making. So kind of goes hand in hand with what you're saying about patient
definitely.
Outcomes.
But I also really like when I remember Mark Skinner saying as well, though, that, you know, as people living with hemophilia or any bleeding sort of the matter, but specifically for, I guess, for us, you know, when we meet up or we go and have a drink somewhere or whatever, we're not speaking about our ABR.
Right.
You know, we're talking about, you know, how some of the difficulties we might have had, whether it was kind of traveling in or, you know, just general day-to-day living or work or the impact of our hemophilia.
Comparing
on
our limbs.
Do you know? But do you know what I mean? I think it's really, like, that is so meaningful.
I agree.
That is so meaningful. And I think I'm certainly hearing a lot of that. But also just a kind of final comment really to that question. I think I'm really there's been such an emphasis on the humanitarian aid side.
Yes, there has.
And I think, I don't know about you, but I feel like that's more than any other meeting so far that I've ever attended.
I've had
that real strong message from everyone.
Everywhere. It seems like it's everywhere. Totally. And I've made this comment, I don't think on the podcast before, but to other people. You know, I'm at like, I don't know, 12, 13, 14, 15 patient events in different parts of the United States every year between local state chapter events, national events. So I go to a lot of places and I hear what people in Iowa are talking about, separate and apart from what people in Texas are talking about, separate and apart from what people in South Carolina are talking about. And one thing that seems to be rather pervasive is an uptick in the awareness of developing world realities for people with hemophilia. That was not the case a number of years ago. Now, I had the same experience as you did so far, thinking that like it is everywhere. It's in the opening plenaries. It's sprinkled into every session I'm going to in one way or another, which on one hand makes total and complete sense, and that's how it ought to be. If your mission is treatment for all, then the growing disparity during a time when we're saying cure, like in the same breath, we're talking about a cure and about how half of all people with severe hemophilia die by 10.
Totally.
Like, how are both things true? That's crazy. And that's what I tell people. If you're interested in all this stuff, I find hemophilia right now, and hemophilia specifically, not all due love and respect to VWD and rare factor deficiencies, but hemophilia right now is fascinating because you've got dead by 10, summit of Mount Everest. The range of life experience depending on ultimately your access to medication, because it all starts there. When there's medication, then the WFH and other entities invest in training of clinicians and education for clinicians and helping capacity build for patient organizations. But when there isn't the medicine, that is the bedrock of absolutely everything. And what we have learned is that while there have been incredible advancements, I think it was yesterday, there was that gap, you know.
It's just steep disparity.
Way to go.
You know, you mentioned Glenn Pierce. Even recently reading the lead author on sort of the update on the humanitarian aid program, the paper that was published. Even in there, you know, it gives you some sense of hope in that, you know, by kind of encouraging the governments in some of these countries to, you know, support the infrastructure and you know, the idea around hemophilia treatment centers, that as innovation progresses, that actually they're going to be more susceptible to those advances potentially later on. And there's a part of me that just walks around, I'm like, you know, it gives you that sense of hope that you think, actually, could these treatments, and again, Mark Skinner said that before in one of his papers around that single high-tech intervention, that you bypass all kind of current treatment that we have, and actually just where they haven't got that infrastructure in place. Now, I'm certainly not saying that you know, you... Again, I totally admire the work that you guys have done, and, you know, with Chris as well. And I've certainly never been involved in any humanitarian capacity before, and it's something I'd certainly love to. But I know here in the UK, people like Dr. Kate Kerr, for instance, she does a lot of work. Also, I totally admire people like Laurie Kelly as well. And just speaking with her and just hearing those experiences. Even Brian Amani as well. I mean, really active. I mean, he was recently in Vietnam, for instance, and sent me a WhatsApp. And some of the images, like... You know, it just totally changes your perspective.
It does. And I think as more and more people are exposed, one of the reasons for the uptick in conversation around it in general is once you're exposed to that, it's hard. You cannot unsee. You know, Chris will talk about when he went to Kenya and he met this boy who was effectively dying because he had an internal abdomen bleed or some kind of internal bleed that was undiagnosed. They didn't know hemophilia. And it was only happenstance that Chris was there helping set up a lab, I think with the Novo Nordisk Hemophilia Foundation, and the docs he were with recognized the symptoms and were like, this boy has hemophilia. But the doctors there had no idea. They gave him an appendectomy. They took this boy's appendix out in Kenya without knowing that he had hemophilia, and he just bled and bled and bled and bled and bled. And he absolutely would have died, except that suddenly, by chance, Chris and these doctors showed up, identified it as hemophilia. They guessed it was A because it's more common, and treated him with factor VIII and their fingers crossed. And after steady treatment for two weeks later, he left the hospital. But like Chris cites that as his, you know, okay, and different. And
things
his wife will
change.
Say he came back a completely changed person. And I had someone just saying to me, who was with me when I was in Senegal in 2015, they were like, I watched you watching all that. And kind of like, it's one thing to hear about it. It's another thing, and you know, now because of the work that we're doing, we're creating these videos, and they showed some of the videos yesterday during
really
that
important.
Session. And so, but then when you go there, then that's really the like that's the final step, is actually being there and seeing. And then the neat thing for me is, having been to these places and met the hematologists and the nurses and the physios and the patient organization leaders, and a bunch of them are here. So it's been neat to see some of them here and be like, you know, how are things? And like, did you see how the video came out? And did you let, you know, that's been really rewarding for me.
But I think, Patrick, that's what's so good about these like network opportunities though. And I think I was really fortunate enough to speak on Sunday. And
yeah, we should talk a little bit. I mean, we'll spill over a bit, but I guess, you know, that's okay. I'm sorry to cut you off, but say what you want to say, but I'd also love you to share a little bit about, because that was on with Dr. Kathy Hyde gene therapy. Just tell us a bit
well,
about
that. Like, just to kind of finish on the humanitarian perspective, I think a part of that talk, I actually spoke about a friend of mine called Rahul, and actually I met him on one of those network opportunities in sort of like the early days, and we stayed in touch. And, you know, his story is exactly the same, that even through him, you know, we went out and I met him in central London, actually not in central, in Canary Wharf, which is the big financial district of London where he's working now. You know, we arrive, you look at him, you wouldn't, a really right. look totally healthy guy.
Right.
And it was awesome. We had a really lovely lunch together. And then for about like 2 hours, just totally unravels, you know, this story of like 3/4 of his life growing up just outside of Mumbai. And it's absolutely like, it even now, like, it totally makes me well up. And you just hear about his experiences, about what he went through, but then to transition. And because he was able to educate himself, and affording himself the opportunity to move to Germany, accessing prophylaxis for the first time. The first day he arrived, he had a bleed. And, you know, that he walked into the center and you know, doctor put him on prophylaxis. He was like, this is the greatest day of my life.
Yeah.
You know, and that things, you know, those types of moments, those types of stories are really important to share.
Absolutely.
But I really wanted to touch on that on Sunday. And like I said, you know, I'm certainly no kind of humanitarian advocate, but I really wanted to add that in, because someone like Rahul, he's moved on to a gene therapy trial.
So that's a guy. Well, that's wonderful too, because that also helps connect that component, right? So
totally.
Gene therapy and the
to
thing
go
that
from
everybody-
nothing like to prophylaxis and then actually move on to a trial. Now, certainly outcomes aside, and I said that,
right,
you know,
right,
I certainly wouldn't want to talk about that on his behalf or anything.
Correct,
but
right.
It's really actually the story.
Yes.
You know, to actually, for someone like him to have experienced absolutely nothing and then this future.
And that's like, why there is hope. Like you were saying about being hopeful. The reason there's hope is because his story exists, because that is possible. You know, we've talked about our mutual friend Abdul.
Yes, totally.
And, you know, he comes from Burkina Faso, right?
And he's got, yeah, he does, Burkina Faso. And his story as well is just
similar yeah. components to, is it Raoul's?
Yeah, Raoul's. Yeah,
Raoul's.
Yeah, yeah.
Similar components with Abdul's story. And that first infusion that he got when he was in France and as a student. I forget why, but I guess these are just stories that show us that while the numbers can be gut-wrenching and painful, and it feels like, man, we just cannot, like, what can we possibly do to like make a bigger difference? At the same time, you watch these individuals and you see it's possible. We have somebody who had nothing and is now on gene therapy clinical trial.
Definitely.
It is possible. We just need to continually work toward what we do to make it a reality.
Yeah.
But I want to talk more about the gene therapy and working with Dr. Kathy High on that. That's like, so interesting.
She, you know what? It was a really surreal moment for me, actually. And just being on stage, and we were like a double act. So it's kind of odd as well. It's just like, normally there's a few more people, right?
Yeah,
as a part of these symposiums. But they kind of said like sort of last minute that it was just going to be 2 speakers. And so it was just really surreal sitting on stage and kind of, you know, big audience and hearing from Kathy, and it was just great. Like, they get, you know, gave me the opportunity to kind of share a bit about my own personal perspective, my own family journey in terms of having 2 older brothers and, you know, hemophilia being in my family with my granddad. And, you know, sadly we lost our granddad as a result of contaminated blood products, so it's really important to kind of learn from that history. And I really try to make that point, especially when we're talking about sort of these novel treatments. And but also, again, really kind of look at how those kind of care needs have manifested as a result of not having that optimum protection in my pediatric years. And that's a really, really crucial point for me that I've come to learn, you know, and that just importance of having, you know, that access to prophylaxis, and also just, again, what those types of services that I require to be able to live as much of an independent and fulfilling life as possible. But also then, you know, I really wanted to kind of support some of my ideas around, you know, this sort of gap in effective self-management for young people. And to kind of put some sort of research that I'm aware of.
It's a huge point of emphasis for you. Why do you... So that gap exists all over the place, you know, in the States we look at that, and it's not just in, it's all kind of chronic disease management. There's this transition age gap where
totally falls off, and especially around adherence rates. Yeah.
And so what are you finding, and from your research or from your experience doing peer led educational sessions and workshops, what are you finding effective at bridging that gap or helping at least reduce it?
Yeah. But I think it's just, at the moment, like, and speaking just from the UK specifically, we have no sort of educational initiatives or programs supporting young people, whether it's in within the context of the comprehensive care centers or whether it's just out in the community, in terms of, you know, proper structured education that's going to support these young people to really recognize and understand what's going on with their hemophilia. And I think, again, I reflect personally on that, you know, things like risk management, understanding the choices that you're making that totally are going to have an influence or potentially have an influence on how you're going to live, you know, later on. And I think back, Patrick, I remember running the cross country. So cross country here, you know, similarly probably in the States, but lots of fields, basically. You're made, the school make you just run the entire village.
See how it's green for forever? Just go. And when it's dark, come back.
Literally that. Okay. But I just even remember doing that year nine, and like I remember my ankle. So I had my right ankle fused around 16 years old. So this was about 14. I just remember doing the cross country, and I think back now I'm like, what on earth possessed me to run that? And I remember being on crutches for a couple of days after.
Yeah.
But I wanted to prove to myself that I could do it, Patrick.
Right. Well, that's fair, you know? And that's and common.
But that's exactly, and I think who did I have to. You know, what type of support did I have around then to kind of recognize and understand what I was doing?
Right.
Obviously, I have my brothers. You know, I was really fortunate and privileged to have a family unit like that. And that's point I made on Sunday. But I just think that actually, I think we need to try and see whether some type of peer-led intervention could really support young people here at least. And whether that type of support is needed. Maybe it's not, Patrick. Maybe it's not needed. We don't. But I think from the research and from the evidence base, I think there's a real lack of that proper peer support, peer-to-peer mentoring and peer support within the context of transition.
Yeah.
Transitional care.
Have you, and not to make you cite research off the top of your head, I'm just genuinely curious, but is there research you've come across that suggests where there are literacy gaps, either in chronic disease management or in any particular, group of people? Have you found research that supports peer-led educational initiatives are particularly successful? Have you seen research that basically says that?
You know what? I've seen a lot of research that is suggesting the idea around peer-to-peer mentoring.
Okay.
Or, again, kind of sort of peer-influenced education. Uh-huh. I would love if any listeners know of any, but purely peer-led, so people with lived experience supplying that type of educational support.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't come across anything
that's really
tried to show some type of benefit, literally just peers. You know, I've seen a lot, again, of kind of sort of peer influence work, but you've still got kind of healthcare professional, you know.
Yeah, it's different. You know, and I think this is not the same at all, and I might be going down such a weird path, but, and again, we can't edit it. We're way too far in now. We're in overtime at this point, so I don't know what I think
I'm
doing.
They're still listening. I hope they are.
I don't know. Only the really...
hardened fans.
The real stalwarts, and that's it. But there's so I wrote a piece a few days ago about my mental health challenges and depression.
That was really powerful, by the way, really powerful, and it's got some great traction online. I think that's really significant, don't you think? How many people have connected with that?
And I think the reason that people are connecting with it, and I anticipated this, so there was the like, okay, do I want to do this? Because if I do this, I think it will resonate, and do I want to take on whatever that's going to mean? And obviously I decided, yes, I was willing to do that. But part of my thinking this was going to resonate was because it was written from a place of experience. It was written from a peer POV. and mental health and addiction kind of live in a side-by-side capacity in many ways. And when we talk about addiction, what do we find tend to be amongst the most helpful ways to support people who are coping with addiction? Well, it's support groups, it's having a sponsor, it's being in the company of other people battling addictions. And that's not to say that an addiction counselor, an addiction specialist, an addiction psychotherapist isn't valuable. Those are valuable parts of a total package of management. Yeah. But to your point, where there are gaps, one of those gaps may potentially only be able to be filled by peer-led intervention.
Totally.
So I think if there isn't, you know, I'm asking you the question because I'm curious about the research, but if there isn't research that nail on the head says peer-led intervention in some cases is the only way to solve certain gaps, there's at least enough stuff that suggests it's worth a friggin' try. You know?
Exactly. But I think there's been, over here in the UK as well, I think there's been a lot of work around transition.
Yeah, and really, we talk about it
really
a lot.
Really meaningful work.
What kind of work?
Well, I think looking at kind of this sort of step programs, you know, the type that supports the healthcare professionals in terms of what type of dialogue they might have at those stages. When do you start having a different kind of
conversation? So because of the way it's structured, and I know in the UK this is a big difference with the US in some ways, programs, and there's a lot of stuff that's targeting the GPs, the general practitioners, and the physicians and the clinicians for them to then engage with the patients and pass on. There's not going direct to the patient in a lot of regards, right? Like in the US, we go to the patient directly in a lot of ways, that I think in the UK, it goes through the doctor.
Yeah, so it's really looked at the multidisciplinary care team, and I think looking at that model and thinking about different types of approaches that can really support and at what stage, you know, to get young people ready for that transition to adult care and taking ownership.
So,
yeah, I think there's some, honestly, there has been some really meaningful work as a part of that. But, you know, I think we should definitely be considering, you know, having people with that sort of lived experience and kind of been through some of that period.
Absolutely.
Which are really challenging times. I don't know if you think back. I think back now. I mean, especially when you're not having a physical transition. And I think often the case here in the UK, you find that, and certainly for my family, you know, we've been under the same comprehensive care centres since we were babies. So how do you change that conversation if you're with the same clinician or you're with, you know, the same nurses that have been there for 25 years?
How can
you start having a conversation around sex?
Well, you know, it's funny that you say that.
You know, I'm pulling that out, but I think that's a real case in point that I've never had a conversation around my sexual activity or sexual health.
No, that's really dangerous.
Because actually, there's certain times you're really putting yourself at risk and you don't know it.
Mm-hmm,
and 100%. It's like, how do you have that conversation with someone who really you've been seeing? And for them as well, it must be really challenging to suddenly one day come in at 16 years old.
Today's the day. Yeah. I've known you all your life, but today we're going to talk about sex.
And also for us, I don't know what it's like in the States, but again, I can really only speak from personal experience, but our sexual health education in school is appalling.
Oh, no, we've got it down.
We're perfect. Patrick just winged, everyone. Winged. I'm sorry.
Do you know that our president 2 days ago, it was revealed, asked Bill Gates the difference between HPV and HIV? That's our president. So if you want to know about how sex is going in the U.S., just take it from there and extrapolate.
But I've got no comment on that.
We've got to start wrapping up before we either get in trouble or we just can't release this because it's not worth anything. But to this point, though, about discussions around challenging topics in the clinic and bringing up sex, let's let that help us transition to one other area I want to talk about that plays into, which is women with bleeding disorders. So you mentioned the humanitarian aid program. There's more buzz, and like that's kind of just a little bit more threaded through everything. That seems to be the case as well, not to the same extent, but the women with bleeding disorders and the movement around women with bleeding disorders certainly seems like it's taking a nice step forward. Today there were sessions basically all day to support women with bleeding disorders. And I just thinking about what you literally just said, we did through our Bloodline podcast series, we did a 3-episode thing on von Willebrand disease, looking at people from the United States and abroad, developed world, developing world, men and women, type 1, type 2, type 3, different subsets, and clinicians on essentially what does it mean to live with von Willebrand disease, and trying to find what the commonalities were, but then all the more interestingly, what all the differences were. Because while hemophilia articulates and is different person to person, von Willebrand disease just really seems to run the gamut in terms of experience. And some of these women talking about bleeding for 2, 3, 4 weeks, I've heard stories of people who have bled for more than a year, consistently nonstop.
Yes.
And like, they become normalized to it because it's, you know, oh, that's what we do in our family. We're just bleeders. Like, no, you have a genetic bleeding disorder. Mm. You're not just bleeders. It's not just some like accepted thing that's true.
Totally.
It's a disorder that can be treated, but they don't know. And then those conversations around, how do I tell my partner? And like, I'm 15 and bleeding constantly and missing school and being teased, and my girlfriends don't have this experience, you know?
Do you know what, Patrick? It's so funny that, you know, I think one, it's a really, really valid point, because actually I feel like they've really dedicated the time to women with bleeding disorders at the Congress, and there's been really useful sessions. But even just now, actually, like heading over to the cultural event, which is obviously a normal occasion. I think we had it in Orlando, and again, it's happening tonight. But actually walking with a girl who had, I think she said, von Willebrand type 2A.
Yeah.
And it's actually tonight, she's just watched her first ever infusion on one of the other girls.
Wow.
And they're both volunteers. And she was really like in a bit of a headspace about it. It's the first time she's ever seen it. She's actually been encouraged by her own clinical team to do it. And she, because at the moment, I might have kind of said that in a different way, in terms of actually watching somebody else with the disorder infuse themselves.
Right, right.
Because at the moment, she's having to go and access to have those infusions at her center rather than kind of be able to self-infuse herself.
Home infusion,
sorry to like a bit of confusion there.
No,
but
that's perfect.
It's still
no.
really significant that, like, you know, she was in a bit of a headspace when we were talking and, you know. And again, like, you know, she was saying, like, you know, I'm 20 now and I want to be able to do it myself. And I'm frustrated the fact that for some reason, like, I hate infusions. I hate watching it. It was really hard for me just to do that just now. And it's like, we don't need, you know, don't put the pressure on yourself.
Right,
you know, we each learn in our own way. But again, actually just having that peer support there.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, for her, and I think for that experience, again, I don't want to speak on her behalf, but just for that experience tonight, I hope that actually she carries that forward. And I think it's going to be really empowering, you know, for her as much as the sessions have been, you know.
Can only imagine. And that goes back to the point you made earlier and was made through a lot of the plenaries about connections and networking, you know, for all the value of sitting in the rooms and hearing the lectures and the data and the presentations, that one-on-one moment where she got to observe another woman with von Willebrand disease infusing, like, that's gotta shape shift the way you...
Totally.
I mean,
amazing.
You know, I guess maybe last thought from me and then one from you and we'll wrap up, but I think a lot about identity. I wish I had it readily available, but this is the nature of doing the raw. I did some writing. I've been doing a lot of writing recently, and I did some writing around the idea of identity and why it's important. And, you know, in the States, I feel like the word identity, and this is biased by my interest in politics, but you hear identity politics as something that is used to categorize when political issues seem to be around someone's identity as a transgender person who's trying to use a bathroom, or I'm a black person who can't get a job, and there'll be criticism about, like, oh, all your politics are not identity politics. Like, it's subsetting people into different groups. And, you know, that's a nuanced conversation that we'll just put over here. But I think but identity in that way just feels like something that can be used as a label and easily undercut and just considered soft and, like, what does it really mean? But to me, identity is someone's psychological, emotional relationship to how they function in the world. And if there isn't some, tell me, name one thing that feels more cementing in a human experience than your emotional and psychological sense of how you operate in the world.
Amen.
And if that is rattled because you can't use a bathroom, because you can't get a job, because you've been discriminated against, because you're not allowed to marry who you love, if that is dismantled for any reason, that's going to rattle your existence.
Yeah.
We on the outside might be like, just use another bathroom. Who cares? That's not the point. The point is that we have just taken that person's sense of their emotional and psychological standing in the world and how they operate in it and said, no, you can't. That's going to screw with people. I think about my brother not identifying as having hemophilia because he didn't bleed a lot, because his bleeding profile was much more like a mild than a severe, because he didn't have an inhibitor like me, because he didn't want to play basketball and get hurt all the time like me. He didn't have an identity, so it was too easy for him to fall off prophylaxis while he was in college, sustain a minor head injury, get a hematoma, and pass away in his sleep. It wasn't because of education. It wasn't because of medical availability and medicine availability and treatment. It wasn't because the clinicians weren't there. It was because he did not identify as having a life-threatening critical illness that would take his life away if he didn't do certain things. That obviously did not motivate his behavior. So when I think about all the work that we do at Believe, whether it's the podcast or web series or the documentary or social media copy, what I care about is that people are engaging. If they're engaging, then there's some amount
it's
of...
It's only a positive thing.
They're
right,
identifying right. with something. Yeah. I hope they're educated. I hope that they took away that piece of data that we shared. I hope they heard that messaging around advocating in the workplace that we shared. But ultimately, what I care about is that they engaged at all. Because if they engaged, they identified. So when someone's identity as a bleeding, as a person with a bleeding disorder from this meeting or any interaction is improved, whether it's because of a one-on-one thing or you're sitting in a session or you heard a podcast, that's a success.
Totally. I'm totally with you.
That's my concluding thought on identity. What would you like to leave people with, Lawrence?
Well, first of all, I just want to thank you so much for the opportunity to come on. You know, I'm a massive fan of your work. I'd love to know you like, your UK fan base. It's got to be out there. I reckon they might be at the hotel now. I reckon they're out there.
Go, Patrick and Lawrence. There they are.
No, you know what? I just, honestly, each time like these events happen, like it's not easy, right? We know that. Some days can be a real struggle, right? And I think it's just so great to be able to come to meetings like this and just feel really encouraged, feel really motivated. You can, you know, you put answers to those questions that sometimes when you're on your own and you're trying to do your advocacy work and you think, why am I doing this? Why am I committing so much personal time to this? You know, is what I'm trying to do, is that really worth it? Am I actually making any difference at all? Man. And actually, when you come to these meetings, it's just so encouraging. I'm so motivated and I'm really excited to kind of get back home and I'm just so proud to be a part of this community. And yeah, it's just an absolute privilege to be here. It's a privilege to be in this position. And I'm just really excited to see, you know, how we get on, over the coming months. And it would be amazing to reflect, you know, in Malaysia in 2 years' time.
No kidding. And let me just say, too, I thank you for the kind words. And I admire and appreciate the work that you're doing. And, you know, I see what you're doing and what you're doing on the Pulse and the articles that you're putting out there and the research and the citing of sources that's going into I see all the work you're doing. And because of the work I do, I feel like I know a little bit of the work that goes behind the work. Yeah. And I know the sacrifices that you're making to do it. So when you say, is this worth it? You know, and all this effort, I want you to know that I appreciate how hard it is to do this kind of stuff. And the sacrifices that must be made and the lack of assurances. And, you know, we are guys who in the primes of our lives have decided to take a lot of our time, energy and resources and put it toward improving lives in this community.
Yeah, yeah.
When there's a whole host of other things we could also be doing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, totally.
Like, let's
totally
be real.
Yeah.
And we've made this choice. And that's a noble and challenging and challenged choice to make. So kudos to you. And yeah, we'll talk before then, but in 2 years from now,
I hope this is like not the end. We're back at Congress tomorrow, right?
That's so true.
And maybe you won't talk to me.
Maybe you'll be back here tomorrow. Who knows? We'll have to find out. But yeah, thanks again for doing this.
Thanks so much. Yeah, it's been awesome.